It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolford. Often the best way to strike up a conversation with an Alaskan is to ask, how did you get here? Most of us would answer with a story about a job or a significant other, but my guests on today's show have better answers because they made the trip north by unconventional means, a kayak or a Super Cub. It's a long way to Alaska from almost anywhere, and even driving is an adventure. Who hasn't dreamed of doing a journey like that under your own power or somehow earning it? Stay with us as we visit with three folks who actually did it to tell their stories. My first guest today is Major Matt Miller. You might recognize him from a show we did recently with some of Alaska's military about their outdoor training and skills. He has a lot to say about that. But while he was here, we started talking about some other stuff he'd done. And he's with us today for a different reason. Matt is a pilot. For his day job, he flies an F-22, the military's cutting-edge fighter jet, Snoopy, Red Baron, that kind of thing, right?
Exactly right.
But as a hobby, he also flies. And he flies has his own Super Cub, which he uses for outdoor adventures in Alaska. It's a really common small aircraft you see everywhere around our state. And it's worlds away from the F-22. It's sort of like the tricycle compared to the Formula One racer, right?
Yeah, something like that.
And so when Matt was stationed here in Alaska, it took him and his dad a week to get here with the plane from the Midwest. And so that for our topic of how do you get to Alaska, flying a slow, small plane is one way.
Yes.
This is quite a journey, and you can only fly so far in a day, right?
That's true. Yeah.
But you had the plane. You knew you wanted it in Alaska. Did you buy it because you were moving here, or you already have it?
My first assignment up here, I was here for 3 years, and one of my friends had a Super Cub. And I tongue-in-cheek kind of mentioned then, if I ever get stationed back up there again, I'm going to buy one because we had a lot of fun with it before. Also at the same time telling my southern wife, if you remember, there's no way they'll send me back to Alaska. So they send me back to Alaska. I say, well, I told you already, I have to buy a Super Cub. So that's kind of what led me there, and then ended up buying one near my dad where he lives down in Illinois. And my dad has a Cessna 180, which is also a tail dragger, very common airplane up here in Alaska. He is as well. Yep. Mm-hmm. So kind of following in his footsteps. And I said, hey, great news. I got Alaska. How about you let me take the 180 up with me during this assignment so I can have it up there? And he told me to go buy my own airplane.
Right, yeah. What is he going to do?
Exactly.
So let's talk about the Super Cub for a minute. I mean, this is like such a piece of Alaska lore and history. What are the qualities that make it a good plane for here?
For me, specifically, throughout a couple of experiences that I've had, is the ability to, take me, friend, all the equipment that I need, a lot of the stuff I alluded to last time, and take and get in and out of places that you just can't in so many other airplanes. Short, rough strips that have angles to them, you know, where you got bushes on either side and alder trees up to the wingtops, you know, and a little bit of hairy places. And I started out very slowly working my way into the bush flying because, you don't want to get up here and crack it up right away.
So it can fly very slow, so that allows you to take a short takeoff, short landing.
You bet. And I actually, when I first bought it, it was closer to a stock Super Cub. So it had the one thing it had really going for it was big range tanks, so larger than stock fuel tanks, which helped me on the way up certainly. But that also came with smaller tires, smaller tail wheel, and a smaller prop. And I actually spent quite a deal of money making it even slower than it already was.
Do you put the big balloon tires on it?
I did, yeah. So it's got 31 tires on it, and the baby bush wheel, and an extended gear, which ends up jacking up the front of the plane, if you will. Think about it, you know, a truck on lifts. And that just all gets you up out of, you know, the rough strips and stuff, and allows you to go in there and out of there without breaking anything, essentially.
Yeah. So what's the craziest kind of place you've landed? I mean, people land them in streams, they land them on mountaintops.
Yeah, and It honestly is, there's at least a couple that I have. And one of the craziest was the one I spoke about last time mm-hmm. when we went back to our ridgeline that we had landed on before. And all of a sudden it was now covered in 6 inches of snow. And I kind of was with my buddy who also had a Super Cub. And he said, on the radio, I said, "You were landing on snow before?" He's like, "Nope." So we're, "All right, well, let's go for it." And everything worked out okay, obviously.
Yeah.
Other than that, I've seen the very narrow, short strips, you know, I'll call it runways in quotation marks. Okay. They're not really runways, but, you know, little clearings. Some that have dog legs into them, like a golf course fairway where you're actually during your landing having to turn one direction or another to keep landing and stuff like that. So
yeah.
there have been some wild ones for sure.
So tell me about planning the flight to Alaska. And you, this is all new to you.
Yeah, absolutely. I had very little civil aviation experience. I had more than most, but it had been a good 10 years before I had done anything in earnest. And again, like I'd mentioned last time, the aviation community up here in Alaska is unbelievably tight-knit. Mm-hmm. And there's a multiple websites with forums, you know, nowadays where you can jump on that thing, type in your search, you know, Super Cub from Midwest to Alaska, and here's all these guys that have done this trip, you know, a whole bunch of times. And you just start gleaning information, you know, left and right about fuel stops and weather and time of year, and you can get just about everything, and even fairly current data, you know, like, well, I used to land here, but you got to talk to Jim, who will get in the truck and drive down, and he's got a couple of gas cans and he'll bring them back for you. So, you know, there's a lot of that kind of stuff too, that you can't pick up a book and learn this kind of stuff. So fortunately, being able to do that, and
people share that information.
Yeah, they do. That's what's been amazing up here as well with the aviation community, as far as the light civil airplanes, is everybody just wants to help everybody else, you know. And so, again, that really helped planning my, okay, I'm going to go here, 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 and here.
So you like sort of set all the beads on the necklace, so you knew exactly where you're going.
You bet. And you know, Mother Nature has a role in that as well, which we found out along the trip. She had a few different ideas for where we might stay the night and things of that nature. But yeah, by and large, I knew kind of the basic steps of where I wanted to go. I had underestimated how long it was going to take to get there.
How far can you go between?
With my extended range tanks, I can go almost 7-8 hours before I end up having to refuel, which is a pretty long way. Now, it completely depends. You know, if I've got a tailwind and I can do, you know, 100 mph, that'll put me pretty darn far. If I've got a 30 knot headwind and all of a sudden I'm doing, you know, 50 mph, you know, things are take quite a bit longer. So that's why with each stop through there, I had multiple, here's where we'd like to go, here's where we're going to go if need be. And then there's another thing called Cub Butt, which is I've been sitting in one spot for
a noisy, crap little spot.
And after you probably about 4 hours is where you're okay, I'm ready
get
to get
out
and
stretch
my legs. Yeah,
you do bet. You ever just stop just to have a picnic? You know, say, oh, that looks like a nice spot. Let's stop and just hang out.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, that sounds so fun.
I've and now, you know, of course, my dad, like I said, he wouldn't give me his airplane. Uh-huh. So now every time he comes up here, he's let's go flying. And we'll go out to the Kinnick and just go, all right, there you go. There's what looks like a good spot, and set it down over there. And
so when you're doing this flight, I guess you land and then you take care of your airplane and then go find a place to eat dinner and spend the night.
Yeah, you bet. And going across Canada was good. No problem there. We stayed in Regina, and then we also stayed in Peace River. And Peace River was the one where we ended up getting stuck for a little while there due to some weather that was rolling in at that time. And then from there, it was essentially kind of following the Alcan all the way from Fort Smith down through Tok and then down to Anchorage.
Mm-hmm. So when you show up at these general aviation airports, which sometimes are there's not a heck of a lot there, maybe nobody's around, then you kind of have to. Do you have a book that says, well, you can get a cab and phone number, or is it sort of like trying to figure out, well, where's
their
payphone?
So the milepost works, actually. Once you get on there, you know, you're not seeing each one of the you know, stops exactly. Uh-huh. But, for example, I went into Watson Lake, and it was covered in snow, and there was, you know, one guy running a plow, and that was about it that was there. And I could only imagine. I've never done the Alcan in the summertime. I'm looking forward to doing that in the future, but... it was one guy with a plow, and we kind of showed up and looked around and said, all right, I think we should probably get gas here and keep on going
because
there was nothing else here right now. You know, it would have taken us a little bit of work.
So what time of year did you do this?
I did this at the end of April.
Uh-huh.
So, you know,
Barely cold, but
end of April, you know, leaving Chicago, we took off of a green grass runway,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then the snow started around Minneapolis, and then it pretty much stayed white for the rest of the rest of the trip.
So, what kind of heater do you have in that thing? Is it adequate?
It's adequate, yeah. And like part of the, like I said, I spent a good chunk of change, not only upgrading all of the gear and prop and stuff like that, but I also added a bunch of safety stuff, plus a rear seat heater, defrost, you know, a lot of things that help out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm planning on doing some winter flying with it on skis this winter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Dad, again, keeps saying, all right, here's what I want you to do next, so he can put it in his logbook.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he needs to invest a little bit in this airplane at this point.
Yeah, I'll let him hear that.
So when you get up to Alaska, I mean, you're kind of following the highway, so the navigation is pretty simple.
Yes, and I'll tell you, the navigation is amazing what they have available these days because I took my iPad, full-sized, which is way oversized in a Cub cockpit,
mm-hmm.
but you can suction that thing to the window, and they've made all kinds of advancements in technology, which make this trip, you know, a lot safer than it used to be.
Yeah.
But I've got a GPS transmitter receiver that, no kidding, Bluetooth over to my iPad, mm-hmm. and an app, it's just an app, that will fly me along any visual chart map.
Wow.
And no kidding, you just see your blue little airplane trucking up the map, and it worked like a champ the whole way up here. And it's got an SOS mode, you know, and mm-hmm. then auto tracking. So people that I knew, my wife and kids and mom were all checking in online, and they could see exactly where I was, exactly
cool?
how high I was, exactly how slow I was going.
Uh-huh. I know. So, he's stuck in place now.
Yeah. Something must be wrong. No, he's just really slowed down.
Yeah.
That happened a couple times, actually.
Yeah, I imagine if you're flying over the highway, it could be a little frustrating if the cars are going faster than you are.
Oh, yeah. And it was funny, the application that I used has a setting where you can set whatever you want your blue GPS blip to be, you know, a mm-hmm. helicopter, light mm-hmm. airplane,
oh,
twin engine jet. And I said, fighter, it's just blank fighter. Yeah. And there's a Raptor.
All right.
So
your plane.
So huh? I'm looking at, you know, the same Raptor that I fly on the other day, but I'm only doing about 60 knots.
Right. So how many days did it take?
It took a total of 7. Uh-huh. And only about 4 of them actually were flying. We had planned to do a few more stops. We had planned for about a week, but like I said, we got stuck by a snowstorm in Canada for a good 3 days before we could get out of there. So right up, pushed to the west edge of the Rockies, and then that whole Alcan was real low weather for 3 days or so. And then by the time it cleared, it was a gasset go, and then each stop was like a NASCAR pit stop to get back airborne just so we could get as far as we could, because
oh,
we were
wow.
kind of feeling behind the timeline. That was a long day in the Cub. That was about 10 and a half hours, I
oh,
think,
my
between
gosh. Yeah.
three different hops.
So you normally fly this high-performance jet, which I imagine can fly in virtually any weather and flies very, very fast and very, very high. And you could probably do this whole trip like in a few hours, right? Or that wouldn't take that long.
Midwest, it would be about 5, I think.
Yeah, maybe
4 or 5 hours total to get
but,
down
but
there.
Then in the Cub, I mean, the difference is you can see every little thing that's going on.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah, it's a whole different world. And I've actually flown some of the different valleys in Alaska in both airplanes. And, you know, I'll do that 4 or 5 times in one of the fast jets, you know, like the Raptor. And I swear I've never seen an animal in the F-22 or the F-15, and they're all over the place in the mm-hmm. in the Cub. You know, it's just because you've got a lot more time to look out the window.
And I imagine when you're flying a high performance jet, you're probably really concentrating on the controls and all this information that's coming at you.
Yeah, it's not my airplane, so
yeah. Thank you for taking care of it.
That's for you guys.
But so, what are some of the coolest stuff you saw on this trip?
I'd say, honestly, probably the coolest part of the trip was that nor my dad or I, who have combined probably 20,000 hours of experience,
wow,
our experience in Cubs was pretty minimal at mm-hmm. that point. So we kind of taken off and, you know, both had kind of seen, and so it was a new purchase. This was, you know, pretty much its maiden voyage for us. So we were doing a little bit of learning on the way up. And the coolest part of the trip for me was 30 hours in a small cockpit with my dad. You know, don't get to spend that much time with him that often. Mm-hmm. I figured out that that's where my knack for repeating stories comes from, you know, because I heard a few of them multiple times during the trip. But
yeah,
we had a great time. And he basically let me sit up front the whole way. We were going to swap out a little bit, but he said it was more important for me to get as much experience as I could flying the airplane so that he felt good leaving here, that I was going to all of a sudden go do a you know, bush flying is something I took baby steps, mm-hmm. Followed a lot of people around, asked a lot of questions, because you could very easily get in over your head if you don't around here, so...
Yeah, you've got to worry about, I mean, in your fast airplane, you don't have to worry so much about like this fitting in between a ceiling and a pass and some of these things.
Yeah, I call them the two throttles on the left, my two get-out-of-jail-free cards. Like, I wasn't expecting to see a mountain right there.
I'm just going
to go straight up.
Oh, wow.
So that does not exist in a Piper Super Cub. Uh-huh. So
you're kind of more in contact with the land and sort of what the topography is and sort of being really aware all the time.
I firmly believe it's made me personally a better pilot because you spend a lot more time thinking about large weather systems and how they interact with the terrain and what you can kind of expect based on different weather patterns. It helps a lot to know that kind of stuff because there's nowhere that I've got to go in that airplane. And mm-hmm. so there's been many times when we've said, not today, you know, we'll save it till tomorrow or next time or something like that, rather than get ourselves in a situation that we don't have the get out of jail free cards and can't get out of. So
I guess your card there is that you can land almost anywhere. So right, have you ever had to do that?
We did have to do that one time on a river with pretty low ceilings. You know, it was like, this is getting a little bit too low for my comfort. There looks good, you know, and make a couple of passes and set her down, have a picnic, like you said, and let it clear a little bit, let the fog lift, usually is something like that, and then keep on trucking. So
wow, what a great way of life and a great activity. I'm really sounds like a lot of fun. I want to thank you again for coming in again, Major Matt Miller, the United States Air Force, flies the F-22, has flown the F-15, and the Super Cub, and made this. The question is, how did you get to Alaska? Well, you've got a good story to tell.
Yes, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right. We're going to take a quick break to hear from Anchorage resident Jen Amstutter. Jen is a biker, and she specializes in doing long trips. In 2006, she flew to Boston and biked back to Alaska. But this story comes to us from the following year, when Jen rode her bike from Valdez to Inuvik in the Canadian Arctic. Lucky for us, she took a recorder along to record the people she met and the experiences she had along the way. Jen's radio diary first aired in 2007 on AK. Rebecca Shear is your host. Annie Fight produced this piece. And without further ado, here's Jen at the onset of her trip.
Alrighty. So, day one, 24 miles plus 4 plus 1. to camping. So here we are, we're unpacking. So here we're getting the sandals. Oh, we're excited to put the sandals on the little feet and let the toes air out. No bugs. Life is good. I'm going to crank some little pasta here with sauce out of a packet. Fred Meyer, thank you very much. Need to hit the old stove here before it goes out after the prime. All our business. Okay, so the stove's on, water's cooking. Dinner up. Alrighty, so I'm all fired up this morning because my only sad spot about yesterday was having to pay for camping. And I got out of it. I stalled for long enough. I went in and was going to be all honest. And he's like, what camping? Did you camp here? Just ride safely, blah, blah, blah. Happy on that one. Free stuff so far. I got given an apricot yesterday. I got given sunscreen. I got given three amazingly well-cooked rolls. Tikal Lodge, FYI, best rolls basically in Alaska, pretty much. So worth the trip. Okay, so this is the sound of the Tazlina River. Oh, and what I was going to tell you earlier was that even though this morning it was like totally easy to sit on my bike seat, right now I have to sit gently when I sit on a picnic table bench. Oh yes, love it.
My name is Rebecca, and I'm originally from Anchorage, and I moved to Gakona, Alaska about 3 years ago, and it's peaceful out here. And we have a lot of squirrels that are gone crazy that like to eat holes in plastic garbage cans and make a big mess for us. And my husband likes to grab his pellet gun and fly out the door like a ninja guy with a gun going after him. A guy down the street in Gakona, he shot a grizzly that was about 9.5 feet tall. I think it was in his yard. I'm not sure, though.
Okay, so that last interview was at a little espresso stand thing. So it cost me an espresso drink and a cinnamon roll the size of my face that I ate all at once. All right, next stop, Grizzlies Lake Campground. Kind of a good name for a campground when you're in a little nylon tent. Cool. Bye.
When she arrived at Grizzly Lake Campground, about 40 miles east of Gakona, she met the family who owns the place. Turns out they also run a small hobby farm.
So do you guys want to tell us what you're doing?
Well, we're feeding our horses, aren't we? We have four horses, and we have chickens. We have about 20 layers, and we get brown eggs and pink eggs and green eggs and white eggs, don't we?
Do we get blue eggs? Is that what you said?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Easter eggs, they're called.
Oh my gosh, you're real.
Dan likes to gather the eggs.
Mm-hmm. So you're Dan?
Daniel.
How old are you?
7.
And then we have about 80 baby chicks in the house.
Oh, wow.
For next year's chickens, mm-hmm. Huh?
Oh my goodness. He's about to fall in. Oh, hi, little guy. Hi. Oh, hi, sweetie. You're lovely. Make some noise. Oh, thank you.
The big ones are hard to catch. They run really fast.
Oh, yeah.
The turkeys are also kind of hard to catch because they run just about as fast as them. The little chicks are kind of easy to catch. You have to be in some certain spots to catch them.
So I'm in chicken. The kindest pass by a big truck was like great state logistics or something. Like slow and gentle. The meanest pass was by a navy blue tour bus, like taking up more than its share on a gravelly section. It's like not fair whatsoever. And so now I scored some gazebo camping picnic tables. I think I can guy out my tent with P-cord because it's gravel everywhere. But this place is gorgeous. Okay, now I'm gonna try and find you some locals. Here goes. Okay, someone tell us your first name.
Robin. I work here at the post office. I'm the postmaster.
And how long have you worked here?
I think it's been about 15 years.
Okay. And how did you end up here in the first place?
Oh, I was so afraid you were going to ask that.
It's a good one. I mean,
the short version is the Mother Earth news. Okay. 25 years ago.
Okay.
Yep. I'd been overseas for a year and a half and was just kicking back one night at my girlfriend's house and saw this ad, some fellow from Alaska, and I thought, oh, Alaska. That sounds fun.
Wow. So were you a mail order bride?
You could call me a mail order bride. Isn't that wild?
That's good.
Yeah.
And so how's that relationship worked out? Are you guys still happy?
How has it worked out?
Yeah.
I wish everybody could be as happy as we are.
Nice.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
Maybe I should look in the Mother Earth movie.
You know what? To be crazy in love for 25 years is really something.
After crossing the border to Canada, Jen met up with her friend Nat and his dad, Barry, who are also heading to Inuvik on bikes.
That's Barry eating. This is Nat.
We paddle, we sleep, we eat. We paddle, we sleep, we eat. On a Faulkner Holly, you just keep going until you drop. Which is part of the fun. And
you can't drop.
And then you just, yeah, you, in the end, you just do it. And it's like down in Central America last year, you just get to a point of fitness where you just all things, you got like this wind blowing 110 kilometers at you all day, and you just sort of chuckle at it. And you know, like you're on the flat going and you're pedaling as hard as you can, you look down at the speedometer, you're doing 6.5 kilometers an hour, and you know you've got this for the next 4 days in a row. And it's just such a great feeling. And then you think about all the poor people laying around on the beaches with their paid holiday with nothing to do, and they're all bored out of their minds. And you feel sorry for them.
Hey, why not?
Tell us about the wind.
That wind today, did you notice it, Jen? It was Arctic as we blew in.
See what a Faulkner holiday's doing to Nat? No matter which way it had come from, it would have been Arctic, because we are in the Arctic.
So I always thought that hot showers was kind of redundant, you know? But I've had a few cold showers, and I've gotten better at them, and here's my trick. You put the pressure on super low, so it's just a bit more than a trickle. And you stand there so it only hits one part of your body, and then it flows over the rest of you, and so theoretically, the one part of your body that the direct cold water is hitting kind of gets desensitized. And then by the time it's kind of traveled a little bit, your body heat has sort of warmed it up and it's tolerable. So that's my trick.
Sure.
Tell us about
Dawson City. Okay. 24-hour daylight. You know, it's kind of cool walking out of a bar, I guess you could say. Sun being up. What else? Midnight golfing. I didn't tell you about that, but you guys are going tomorrow. You can walk out of a bar at 2 o'clock, get a cab over to the golf course, and tee off at around about 3 in the morning. Yeah. Get a little golf cart, go around the swings, have a few beers, a few more, I guess. Yeah. Dawson City's just a really big drunken town for all the people who work here. It's all it is. It's everyone just either gets drunk or goes canoeing or hiking and such. So, yeah. Gorgeous.
Okay, there were some road sounds for you. Oh, here we have an RV. These are classic. This is the real deal. The American dream. The beige RV on the Alaska Highway. They got worried. They slowed down. I gave them a thumbs up.
Did you know the song, Blue Nose?
You mean the Farewell to Nova Scotia tune?
Maybe.
Farewell to Nova Scotia, the sea-bound coast. No. Let your mount. No. Blue Nose. No, can't say that I do. I should. I have the plate.
I know, that's what you said. Do you want to do this one?
All right. That's my own. If I can't remember this one, I'm really screwed.
Jen Miller made the 1,000-mile journey from Valdez to Inuvik in 15 days. Then she hitched a ride to the Alaska border and spent a week biking home to Anchorage.
night. You should have seen the crowd at the harbor. Put down my umbrella and loosen my tie.
You're listening to Outdoor Explorer on KSKA Anchorage. The program repeats tonight at 9 o'clock on FM 91.1. Connect with Outdoor Explorer anytime. Download podcasts and see what's coming up on future programs by going to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Child, she was a witch in disguise. She floats in the bay in a tiny birch basket. I saw through her eyes. I asked if the tide was coming in or the land was going out to sea. Searching to find what painted eyes cannot see. They're missing the stars, the city so bright. It burned off the night and turned to headlights on cars. It burned off the night. Turn to headlights on cars.
We're back. You're listening to Outdoor Explorer. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. My next guest is Nadia White. In 2012, she sea kayaked the inside passage all the way up to Juneau, and did it completely solo by herself. Nadia's trip was part of a bigger project to follow in the footsteps of her grandparents, who were a pair of journalists, both her grandmother and her grandfather, and who came to Alaska aboard a steamship in 1898. Quite an amazing story in itself. She joins us from Missoula, Montana, where she's currently working on a book about her travels, and she teaches journalism at the University of Montana at Missoula. Thanks for being with us, Nadia.
Thanks, Charles.
So you were in your 40s, and you suddenly decided to get in a kayak and kayak to Alaska. And you launched, and your friends on shore turned to each other and said, "We may never see her again." Quite a dramatic beginning of your story. What possessed you to try to do this? I mean, had you ever done anything like it before?
I had never sea kayaked anything like this before. It was a overreach of my skills for sure. But I was really possessed at, I was in my 40s, by a youthful exuberance that was born on the rail of the Inside Passage Ferry when my family had done a family roots trip up on the ferry when I was 13 or 14. I always swore I'd go back. I just didn't know it would take so long.
Huh. Interesting. And so your preparation was reading books and sort of talking to people about what it was going to be like, and then just a lot of, I would say, courage.
and no small amount of luck. I did go out to the Olympic Peninsula and took spent some time kind of playing in rougher water with some experienced sea kayakers. I do have some whitewater experience, although I'd hate to bet my life too heavily on that. And then I have off and on sea kayaked around. I had some experience up in Hudson's Bay and some experience on other bodies. But what I had never done was navigate the kinds of tidal shifts and currents that you experience in the Inside Passage. And for me, that's where a healthy dose of luck, caution, and courage worked out okay. I mean, that's what makes the Inside Passage both interesting and tricky.
Yeah. Well, I like that you wrote about it in the High Country News in 2013, and folks can find that article linked to our website at alaskapublic.org. Just click on today's show and you'll find those links. But one of the, I enjoyed the incident you described, which is the pure Alaska greenhorn experience, where you camp and you get up the next morning and the water's gone and you've got to like get all your gear across the mud flats back down to the water.
I don't know how you avoid that. It happened one direction or the other every day. and so I'm not sure if you Alaska natives have figured out how to get the tides to work a little more in your favor, but it was a pretty, that first day, there was 150 yards of mud to navigate.
Your trip feels so much like an exploration of the kind that somebody might have done in 1898, like your grandparents coming up, because the land is still very wild. And you were still really learning the ropes, and you were kind of exploring, weren't you?
Well, I was in so many ways exploring, and part of exploration really is pushing the edges of what you know. And a hardcore definition might be pushing the edges of what is known. And there are fewer of there's less out there now than there was 100 years ago, but the edges of what I know are pretty available to me. And that's what I was really poking away at. There are probably fewer people living along the Inside Passage today than there were when my great-grandparents, when they went up. And so they went up in 1898. And there were quite a few communities along the way that don't exist anymore. Lots of stories about these little towns that had infrastructure for the traveler. And those are often gone or in ghost town relic condition. It's an exploration of what is and what was.
Yeah. So what did you learn about yourself from this trip?
Wow. It's like an alternative reality, the time you spend in that kind of a solo trip, learning both humility, patience, and a connectedness of self to place, even though the place I was moving through was changing every day. I really did learn to be most purely myself, I think, both with my patient, with myself, forgiving of myself, and really embracing of the people I met along the way, all sorts of characters who may not intuitively be my friends in my daily life, were wonderful and have become long-term friends because I met them on my journey.
Yeah, a word you used there, humility, I think is such an important one because, you know, people think, well, you did this heroic journey. You must think, well, I conquered the inside passage. I am hot stuff. But really, when you're out there on your own by yourself, what you're learning is that this journey is much, much bigger than you are. And you need luck and you need skill and you need help and all of those other things. So humility is an interesting word for you to pick out there.
Oh, I think if there were just one word to define what I learned and what I embraced on the trip, it would be just that, Charles, humility. Every time I successfully navigated what I knew to be a challenge, each day in my journal, I'd mark what I anticipated to be the crux of the day. And there was always something. And each time I successfully navigated that challenge, I really gave thanks to the greater world around me, that I had anticipated correctly what I was going to have to do. It was not, you know, there's a lot of luck involved there, but there's good planning. Good planning makes good luck is what they say.
Yeah, that's right. So in talking about journeys to Alaska, it sounds like your great-grandparents were pretty remarkable people. He was a journalist who ended up being the first political columnist in Southeast Alaska, but that she was sort of the even more incredible person because of just the disadvantages of women in those days, that she was a journalist and then she really made a mark when she got to Alaska. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, he was he had been a journalist. He was 13 years older than she, and they met in Sumner, Washington, when she showed up to visit her sister, who was married to the owner of the paper he worked at. And they started working together and eventually decided to join households and forces. They moved north he was one of the first reporters to cover the arrival of the gold coming down from the Klondike Rush, but they didn't take off right away. He waited till he had a job offer from the Skagway News and took off in April of 98, and she followed by steamship with their 4-year-old daughter. And the challenges of being a mother on kind of in this adventure are really something.
Incredible. And because he got an odd job offer from the Skagway News, but a year earlier there hadn't been a Skagway, right? So everything was just
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, it was absolutely. He got there in time to really become quite close with Soapy Smith, chronicled a lot of the rough and tumble times of Skagway, and then they, as things were, they moved. They just kept going. So he worked there. He worked his way north. Then she went with him, sometimes working, but mostly raising the family and putting food on the table, as journalists are sometimes not so good at actually getting their paycheck and spending it on food. So she was a good hunter and a good mom, and I have funny stories of her and her daughter, young daughter, riding their bicycles around Skagway, which is hard to imagine at that time. So they left Skagway. He worked at the Bennett Sun for a while, and then they made their way to Dawson, where the newspapers were shifting kind of on a daily basis. And he worked at the Klondike Nugget, the Dawson Daily News, and then he started his own paper, which was called the Dawson Freelance. Did that for a little while, and then he retreated to the White Horse Star as Dawson went bust. He took over ownership of the Star in 1903. Well, the guy who founded the Star was this same guy who had hired Stroller White back in Sumner, Washington. So these two sisters had actually gone north, but not together. So it's a funny little family tangle of women and journalism and family raising in the Klondike era.
So all these places you're visiting on your kayak trip, you're sort of retracing their steps. But it sounds like you got the idea when you're much younger and you were on a family trip on the ferry coming up. And tell us about how you got inspired to do this.
You know, there is something for everyone, I think, who's travels the Inside Passage about what the Inside Passage doesn't share easily. It's so full of curves and steep edges of forests that are just impenetrable. And I, as a 13 or 14 year old, I remember being on the rail of the ferry and just thinking, I have to get around that next corner. I need to see what's on the other side of that island.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've had that exact feeling. Yeah.
Oh, it's just so compelling. And even in a kayak, even when I went around the corner, there were more corners I wanted to go around. So that wonder really never left me. It is only my commitment to duties back home that keep me from just kayaking. It's an endless place to explore and to kind of experience both the place and yourself, I think. So I gave into that.
One thing that you pointed out in your article was that there are kayakers along the way who are just setting out from the towns or maybe doing base camp trips, and then there are a small number of sort of through kayakers. It reminded us, we were talking about it, sort of a little bit like the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Crest Trail, where you have these through hikers and you have the people who are along the way. And you were a true through hiker on this thing. And what was the culture of the kayakers like, and of the people you met out there who are real outdoors folks?
Oh, you know, they're so neat. I remember one day, maybe a couple weeks into the trip or fewer, when the blisters on my hands were fully inflated and quite painful and disgusting. And I stopped on an island to camp and was just walking around, and I walked into someone else's camp. And they were these people who base camp and explore the Inside Passage one little chunk at a time and have been doing it for years. Very experienced kayakers, very experienced campers. And they greeted me, were just terrific. And she took one look at my hands and said, "Give me your hands." And she took an old Folgers coffee can, unwound a couple turns of duct tape from the lid, and pulled out her first aid kit. She swaddled my hands in aloe, put on a loose bandage, and then put on a pair of surgical gloves over that, and then gave me some extra surgical gloves. And she said, "Wear those under your paddling gloves, and your blisters will heal." And it was just a classic, "Here, I know what you need, and I can give it to you." And that's the attitude that I saw time and again from people who knew those waters and knew the challenges much, much better than I did.
Mm. Yeah, and that is a really good story. But it also brings up that must have been one of your big challenges, was your hands falling apart. You said your feet were constantly wet and kind of split open. Were those the biggest challenges and sort of difficulties you faced, or were there some other ones that you may not have mentioned?
You know, my hands quickly healed and just got tough. My feet kind of went through the same process. Both were pretty pruny and water loggy for some time after the trip. Luckily, no one else was around. Probably the biggest offense was that I stunk. I think had I kept going longer, I would have had to become more careful about my food. I think I got tired of eating mushy food and a fishing fleet tender. Towards the end of my trip, we got pulled into Taku Harbor, just south of Juneau. A big storm was coming through, and a lot of ships pulled in, and I was tucked in there already. And we got to talking, and the wife on one of the tenders went into her, and the whole thing's a floating refrigerator, and she brought out all this fresh fruit. And I had real canker sores in my mouth, and those were gone by morning after I ate the fruit. So I think I needed to learn something about nutrition along the way.
Yeah, you were learning a lot of this stuff sort of by trial and error, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and I also thought it was interesting when you ran into your first tide rip. You'd never seen one before, and that sounds like it was pretty scary.
Oh, my gosh. I'd never seen anything like that from the water perspective. You know, you're in a kayak, and your chin is just a foot and a half off of the surface of the water. I hit the timing just right. I came around a corner, and I swore that there were the four horsemen of the apocalypse rising up out of the water in front of me, coming at me at a full gallop. I just threw it in reverse. It was in a pretty good current, taking me right into the rip. And luckily, I ducked into an eddy and just sat and watched and was amazed. And, of course, I saw countless tidal rips in the course of the rest of my trip and learned so much from that first one. But in that first one, my mind was just racing to explain the inexplicable. There was a set of rapids right ahead of me, and I didn't know what to do.
So, right, and these things, these are waves that are very sort of violent and can be kind of chaotic that will form around headlands and places where you have differences in depth and a strong current is going over them. And there's not too much you can do about it, right? You got to find your way around in a kayak.
I just sat and watched it for the longest time, and I thought maybe it'll go away. And what I know is, and really I learned as I went, is it would go away if I sat long enough. If I let those tides go to slack, everything would be like glass. But I didn't quite know that then, so I snuck around between the waves and the rocky shoreline, and everything was fine. But that's probably, besides humility, what I learned was patience.
Yeah, patience, yeah, when you're kayaking and dealing with the tides and the oceans, yeah. So you've done this amazing journey and sort of lived to tell about it. It sounds like it was really positive in most ways, and you're working on a book. Do you see yourself doing another epic journey? Is it the sort of thing that you figured, well, I've done that, I don't have to do it again? Or did it give you a taste for challenging yourself at that level and would like to try something else?
I would love to try something else, and I imagine I will. There are actually, my goal for this, the Inside Passage was the middle part of a journey following my great-grandmother's entire migration, of her life's migration. So I actually started in Oklahoma on a bicycle and rode my bike up to right near Tacoma, Washington. So that was a terrific 45-day ride across really most of the mountains in the lower, kind of the American West, right? And I had never done a solo bike journey, and that offered great opportunities and was its own wonderful adventure. And then once I got to Juneau, and I did my exploring there, and I actually ended up going to Skagway with my parents, which was wonderful. I had planned on kayaking it, but I'm very happy that I went with my parents because it's, after all, it's my father's family I'm following. And there I teamed up with the current publisher of the Skagway News, who is part of, he was the founder of the Yukon River Quest. And when he heard that I needed to get to Dawson, he said, well, let's put you on a team. So this past summer, I did the Yukon River Quest with a team from Skagway and Whitehorse and made my way all the way to Dawson, which was ultimately my goal. So I have those kind of those two adventures that buttressed the Inside Passage portion of my trip.
Wow. What a great story. What a great odyssey you took. And I'm very envious for your adventures. And thank very much for having you with us, Nadia White. She's teaches reporting and journalism at the University of Montana at Missoula, and she kayaked the Inside Passage and did this amazing bike ride and everything else she just told you about, and is working on a book, which is not ready really to talk about yet. It's not done being written, but it's going to be interesting when it is. And if you're interested in reading more about Nadia's journey, you can find a link to an article that she wrote in the High Country News at our website, alaskapublic.org. So thanks a lot for being with us, Nadia, and good luck with your writing.
Thanks, Charles. I'll let you know when the book comes out.
You just heard from Nadia White, who soloed the Inside Passage 2 summers ago. It's an epic trip, sort of like the sea kayaker's equivalent of the Appalachian Trail, and it can be really challenging, not to mention dangerous. But this year, one group has put a bounty on it. The Race to Alaska has a $10,000 cash purse for the first one to sail, row, or paddle their way from the lower 48 to Alaska. Second place is a set of steak knives. KRBD's Ruth Eddy talked with the race's co-founder, Jake Beatty, about the 750-mile sprint.
Really, we just wanted to keep it as simple as possible, bare minimum, so that the race was as pure as the route itself. Get a boat without an engine, go to Alaska.
The starting horn will sound June 4th this summer in Port Townsend, Washington, with the finish line at Ketchikan's Thomas Basin Boat Harbor. Beatty made his first trip to Ketchikan this week to figure out some logistics and introduce the race to Ketchikan residents.
You know, I don't know what it's like to live in Ketchikan, but I know what it's like to live in a tourist town. And it's nice to have something that isn't for tourists.
The race is designed as an antithesis to the comfortable cruise, and like the race itself, the people who've signed up are a bit wild. Among them are a chin-up champion, a French sailor, a Canadian kilt manufacturer, and a record-holding stand-up paddleboarder. The race is still accepting applications.
I don't think at this point we said no to anyone, but we've asked enough hard questions that they came up with the conclusions themselves.
With no class divisions for sizes or types of watercraft, there's been a lot of speculation about what boat will finish first. Maybe a sailboat or a rowboat or something altogether new.
There are at least four new boat designs that have been developed for this route, for this race. You know, everything from traditional Polynesian design, but done in carbon fiber, down to more accessible marine plywood and epoxy sort of construction.
Beattie likes to think the race is a combination.
A cross between the traditional canoe journeys of, you know, the native people have been plying this route since time began, mixed with the winner-take-all sort of gold rush energy that that route really became famous for in sort of the European culture.
While other adventure races may give out more prize money overall, the $10,000 for first is the biggest purse for water sport in the world.
And it's the only race I know of that gives out steak knives for second prize.
Yes, although a serious endeavor, Race to Alaska maintains a lightheartedness about it, including its homage to the cutthroat sails competition in the 1992 movie Glengarry Glen Ross.
As we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest, as you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize, a set of steak knives.
Beattie says one contestant told him he's specifically after those knives. There are also a few racers after nothing more than the experience, using the race as an excuse for adventure. In Ketchikan, I'm Ruth Eddy.
That's all for today's show. You heard from Matt Miller at the top of the hour, followed by journalist and kayaker Nadia White. The segment you heard in the middle of the show was an audio diary from Jen Amstadter's solo bike trip from Valdez to Inuvik. Music was by Alaska artist Michael Howard. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. We had help today from Shanti Johnson in Montana, Evan Erickson, Annie Fite, and Ruth Eddy here in Alaska, and our regular lineup, Monica Gokey and Grace Bogene. I'm your host, Charles Wolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. Theme music is by Portugal, The Man. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect the station or its underwriters. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and on iTunes. To see what's coming up on Outdoor Explorer and add your voice to the conversation, go to our website at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.